This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Well, I've never been one to worry.
Welcome to the program today. Glad to be with you. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and News Radio 1440 Facebook Live. Glad to be with you as always. It is Tuesday morning. Lots of news to cover. Far too much for us to be able to do in one sitting, but we're going to do the best that we can. And of course, the top story of today, some local news going on. There has been a new development, and we've been covering this story very closely with the shooting that happened in Hoover. So just a quick brush up for those of you who may not remember. What happened in Hoover is Thursday night on Thanksgiving during a Black Friday event. They had all these sales going on, and so what happened is a bunch of shoppers came in and did what shoppers do on Black Friday and started fighting over different merchandise or to get deals or whatever. There was an altercation that happened over a pair of tennis shoes, of all things, and apparently this dispute led to people opening fire. Now, initially, we believed the gunman to be dead. But what happened after that is that the police had an altercation with a man that was armed, and there were reports earlier that he actually was one of those involved in the initial altercation, but the police officers had shot him and believed that he was the shooter. Turns out later, based on forensic evidence, that was not the person who was actually doing the shooting. So there's a lot of reason for concern, and there are a lot of people that, because of that, speculated that there was something to do with this police officer, that he used his use of force as a officer of the law incorrectly, that he just fired on the person, you know, essentially not doing so correctly. This guy apparently was not a threat, according to some. But there are also other sources that say that the police officer had ordered at least twice for this person to drop his weapon and to put his gun down. So there's a couple of different theories floating out, but these are the latest developments on that. ALEA, which is the head law enforcement agency for the state of Alabama, has taken over the investigation, and they announced that they will not be releasing evidence. You'll remember that we talked about this very briefly yesterday, that they had planned to, in a press conference that occurred at about 10 o'clock, so right around the time this show was on, they had talked about actually bringing that information forward, showing the footage, but turns out at the press conference, it was actually not to do that. It was actually to announce that they would not be doing that. So all we got was an announcement that they were not going to be releasing any new information. And so we'll go through that really quickly. Hoover Police Chief Nick Derzis, I believe that's how you say his name, Nick Derzis, spoke at ALEA's press conference the other day, and he said this, quote, "Hoover officials are respecting the request of ALEA not to release any information at risk of compromising the justice process for everybody involved." So that deadline the other day that Hoover had announced that they were going to release the footage regardless of what ALEA said, that is essentially gone. The police chief there, Nick Derzis, has said that, yeah, we're not going to release it. After all, ALEA has requested that we not do so, and so because of that, we will not be releasing that information. But the wording here is really important. The wording here is really important because if you read the last part of that statement, what he says was that they were not going to release that information at risk of compromising the justice process for everyone involved. Personally, and again, this is speculation on my part, so don't take this to the bank. I find this highly suspicious. And maybe I'm worrying for nothing, but my spidey senses are tingling, and I've been at this for a while now, and it seems to me that something odd is going on. I don't know what that odd thing is. It could be foul play. It could be something else. But nonetheless, I'm sensing that there's something more here that we don't know. And whatever that may be, I'm very curious to find out what it is, and it's looking more and more like actual corruption. Doesn't mean that it is. Sometimes there's smoke and there's not actually a fire. That does happen. It's rare, but it happens. And so it bothers me, though, that they're so tight-lipped on all the evidence. It bothers me that they are working so hard to keep any footage of this event happening from coming to the public eye. That bothers me. And maybe there's a good reason for it, but the fact that he said compromising the justice process for everybody involved, here's my question. Who else is involved? Because as far as I know, the only people involved, at least in particular the shooting of Bradford, would be the police officer and the victim. And the victim's dead, so that only leaves the police officer. And if that's the case, it seems to me what they're trying to do is they're saying, there's some evidence here that looks really bad for the police officer. And because of that, and because we're worried about compromising the justice process for those involved, again, the only person that's left involved that's not dead would be the officer. So it seems what they're concerned about is protecting his right to justice, which, by the way, he has. He has a right to tell his story. He has a right to be heard. He has a right to have the evidence looked at and a jury of his peers decide whether or not he actually did something wrong or not if this reaches that level and winds up going to a court case. So I absolutely believe that he deserves to have his side of the story told. What bothers me is they're acting as though this evidence doesn't need to be out in the public for whatever reason. I don't know that there's something nefarious going on underneath the surface. I don't, and I'm not going to pretend to. I'm just letting you know that as somebody that spends quite a bit of time researching the news and has done a lot of stories that are in a similar light, it really bothers me that they've waited so long to release this information. I mean, we're a long ways past Thanksgiving now. Weeks at this point. I mean, I guess it would be technically Thursday that it'll be 2 weeks. And that is suspicious. That bothers me that they're waiting this long for this. And maybe, again, I'm just spitballing here because I don't have the information, so spitballing is the best that I can do. The only thing that I can think of is that maybe there's somebody else other than Bradford, if he's not the one that they're worried about compromising the justice of. Maybe there's a third person involved in this that we don't know about. That's the only thing I can think of. We know for a fact that it was the police officer that shot Bradford. It's not like there was a third person with a gun, or at least there's been no indication from any reports that that's the case. So was there a third person involved in the altercation? What's going on here? I really just do not understand why they are being so hesitant to release this footage. So in my mind, and again, this is speculation on my part, but I can only think of three possibilities that make sense, at least to me. One of those possibilities is this is a cover-up to protect the officer. That's the most obvious one. That doesn't mean it's the most likely one. Doesn't mean it's the correct one. It means it's the most obvious one. And so it is a possibility, and I'm not saying that this is true, it is a possibility that what is going on here is they're looking at the evidence and seeing, ooh, that looks really bad on the part of the police officer. And so what we're going to do is, because we're worried about people forming their opinions before they have all the facts, what we're going to do is we're going to keep a lid on this footage because it looks real bad for the officer involved. That is possible. And if that's the case, if you're worried about that, I don't see how that's a justification. Because when the court looks for a jury, if it, again, it rises to that level, they're going to look for people that can be impartial. And here's the issue that I have with this going forward, and this really bleeds into the second possibility, which I think is also, I don't know if it's less likely, or sorry, it's less obvious, but I think it's more likely. The video is inconclusive, and they're trying to avoid armchair judges. I think that's the second possibility that we're dealing with. That it's not that it absolutely makes the police officer look bad, but it's at least highly questionable. And because it's highly questionable whether or not the police officer was acting correctly or not, what they're worried about is everybody making a decision on this case and basically acting as an armchair judge. Which, here's the issue with that approach. If that's their approach, I at least understand their logic, but it's really not working if that's their approach, because people have basically already made up their mind about this case, unfortunately, most of the time. Most people have basically already decided that I'm siding with Bradford or I'm siding with the police officer. which is not the way that we should do it, especially when there's a lack of evidence. And that's not something that I would encourage people to do. But unfortunately, the vast majority of people have made up their mind anyway. And so the minority that's still holding the jury out, in other words, that they're still waiting on the evidence to make a decision for how they think about the case themselves, those are not the people that you have to worry about anyway. It's the irrational, crazy people that are going out and protesting with no facts and no evidence that you have to worry about, and they've already made up their mind. This video could come out and show that the police officer acted exactly the way that he was supposed to, and they would still go out and protest and call for justice, or at least their form of justice. We saw this in Ferguson. We've seen it time and time and time again. These people are not ones that are thinking clearly or that are protesting in such a way that they are trying to maintain the peace. This is the issue that you're running into. A lot of those people, because they have already made up their opinion, their mind, and they've already got their opinion, that's what they're worried about. So on this possibility that the video itself is somewhat inconclusive or somewhat fuzzy on what the officer should have done, I think about the Philando Castile case. Now, the Philando Castile case, we found out stuff later that we were lied to about. For example, the girlfriend claimed that he had a concealed carry permit. He had never had a concealed carry permit. And so that was a complete lie. He did not have the legal authority to have his firearm the way that he did. And that was a case where the guy goes reaching for his gun and to alert the officer and let him know that he is carrying. And the police officer keeps telling him, don't go for the gun. Don't go for it. And then he winds up firing on the guy. Honestly, the reason that that case was so heart-wrenching is because if I'm the guy in the car, in other words, if I'm Philando Castile, I'm thinking, well, I'll go ahead and pull out the gun and surrender it to him so that I don't have to worry about anything anymore. And the police officer is sitting there thinking, he's going for his gun. I've got to do something. He might hurt me. He might hurt somebody else. And so both of those guys, you could kind of come up with a justification for, at least in their own minds. And that's what made that case so sticky. And I'm wondering if there's a similar situation that's going on here to where the police officer was not acting irrationally per se, but maybe it makes it a little bit more fuzzy as to what the police officer really should have done. Or it's not necessarily 100% clear that this guy was a threat, even though he happened to have a firearm on him. And so there's a couple of possibilities there that I think the Philando Castile case may give us a little bit of insight into the reason that they're worried about releasing this footage, that the footage itself is unclear, and because of that, it doesn't really do anything to clear up who was right and who was wrong. I don't know if that's true or not. And then there's the third possibility, and this is the dark horse possibility. There is some kind of unforeseen X factor that is going on that this video shows that we don't know about. In other words, they have a very good reason for keeping this in the shadows, but right now, because we're the public and we haven't seen the video, we can't possibly understand exactly what that is. And because of that, and because of this detail, whether it's a third party being involved or whatever else it may be, because of this detail that we're missing, we can't really give an informed opinion on what's going on. And because of that, because they're afraid that it would compromise the case involved or whatever else it may be, or, you know, maybe there's a witness that is there. I really have no idea what this could be. But because of that X factor, they actually do have a good reason for not releasing the footage. We just don't know what it is yet. And I really can't give any more commentary on that because I would have to have some idea of what the detail was before I could do so. So in my opinion, those are your three options. Now, there was news the other day that a private autopsy that was commissioned by the attorney for the Bradford family, Benjamin Crump, who is a far left leaning activist. There's some issues with that guy. He did bring in a medical examiner who is a very credible physician. He is a medical examiner for the District of Columbia. So Washington, D.C., he's their, I think, chief medical examiner. So this was conducted by Dr. Roger A. Mitchell Jr., who, based on everything I saw, and I didn't spend a ton of time researching him, but I did do a little digging into his background, he seems very qualified, at least from a medical perspective. He does also kind of seem like a bit of a political activist, and so there may be at least a hint of reason for him to lean a little bit more towards the left on this. And I don't think that a case like this should be quantified in terms of left or right or this side or that side. We should all be for the side of justice. We should all be for the side of finding the truth. But nonetheless, it's more like in this case, if there was a doubt in the guy's mind, he may be a little bit more apt to hear the case or to believe that this young man was attacked and killed unjustly. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that you don't take this into consideration. I'm just saying take it with a grain of salt, because if I believe the autopsy was worthless, I wouldn't be bringing it up. So let's look into what the autopsy by Dr. Mitchell Jr. actually said. According to the review, he was shot 3 times, the head, the neck, and the back. And according to this same autopsy, all 3 times it took place in the back. So I actually have a graphic where you can see the presentation yesterday, and that's the physician right there who's explaining this. So you'll look there and you can look at this diagram. You can see on the top picture that shows the alleged victim's face from the front, you can see where that bullet wound is, and you can see where the bullet's entry point is in this lower one. So if you look, and his arm's kind of in the way, but you can still see the trajectory of the bullets and where the wounds took place. You can see the bullet entry point and the exit point. And so what this finding was, and this is what he reported, is that they all struck Bradford from behind and at a slight upward angle. Now, what exactly does that mean? Does this tell us anything when it comes to whether or not the officer was justified in his shooting? Well, really, no. But there is one thing that is possible, and this may clear up at least this one detail. It seems as though it was not a standoff situation. Or if it was a standoff situation, it was one that Bradford fled from. And what I mean by that is, you didn't have two people sitting there shooting and exchanging fire in a gunfight with one another. Because if that's the case, then there's no way that Bradford could have been struck in the back like this. Struck in the back of the head, the back, and then the back of the neck. And so there's a couple of different theories revolving around this. It could be that the officer snuck up on him, saw the gun, and then opened fire without ordering him to drop the weapon, without alerting him to his presence. He just saw a gun, goes, oh, there's the bad guy, and then started firing. That's possible. I don't know how likely it is, but it is a possibility. And as somebody who is a concealed carry weapons holder myself, believe me, I understand why that would be a cause for concern, because if that is what happened, then the police officer is 100% in the wrong when it comes to that, because for all he knows, this is just a concealed carry permit holder who happens to have a firearm, not doing anything wrong, actually trying to help people and trying to find the gunman himself and subdue him. And if even though it's very, very, very rare, these cases do happen where somebody who is a lawful, law-abiding citizen like myself that happens to have his firearm on him pulls his weapon in this predicament to protect himself and to protect other people, winds up unfortunately being mistaken for the bad guy and winds up getting shot or killed. That is a possibility. I don't know how likely it is, but it is a possibility that that is what took place. But the only thing that makes that seem a little less likely is the angle is odd. The angle seems really odd to me. Maybe this guy was crouched somewhere behind something that he viewed as cover, and then the police officer came up on him from behind and shot him that way, and because he was crouched, that would explain the angle, but that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. And so it doesn't seem as though the police officer was like on a lower floor or something, and that would be really odd and awkward to shoot at too. So again, there's just some things that don't seem to add up, and it's a shame that we don't have the video because that would probably clear this up. It could be also that Bradford was brandishing the gun at others, and so he opened fire. And so if he's being struck from the back, it's also possible that Bradford is there waving the gun around, trying to find out who it is that's in the vicinity. He could be looking for the gunman. He could be somebody that was involved in the shooting itself, and somebody that was a bad guy. It just so happens that his bullets didn't strike the people who were victims, in this case, I believe it was an 18-year-old and a 12-year-old. And so it's possible that he's threatening people, waving his gun around, And so the police officer is 100% justified in shooting him despite the fact that his bullets happened to hit in the back. Because if you're a police officer and you show up and there's a guy waving a gun around, menacing it and waving it at people, I think you're justified in taking that guy down. And so that also is a possibility. And then there's a third option as well. It could be that the officer ordered him to drop the gun, and what Bradford did was turn and run away. So in other words, this could also be true, that the witness that was in Spencer's that night that we heard from Matt Murphy, that account was true, and the police officer said, hey, drop the gun, and he didn't do it, and instead of dropping the gun, he decided not to fight the police officer, but to instead run away. Now, if that happened, the police officer may be thinking, this guy's going off to kill more people, I've got to bring him down. And if that was the case, and this is the reason I think it's the most likely, that also might explain the angle. Because if you're running, especially when you're running really hard, you tend to lean forward a little bit. And if you lean forward and somebody is shooting you from a shooting position, a standard shooting position where your arms are locked and you're looking down like this, if somebody's running away from you and they're sort of crouched down in a running position, that might explain the angle. And so again, I don't know if this is actually what happened, but to me, this seems like the most likely scenario. That the police officer ordered him or alerted him to his presence, told him to drop his weapon. He didn't. Instead, he chose to run away. And because of that, the police officer shot him in the back. He shot him as a fleeing suspect. I think that's the most likely one to me. And the autopsy did yield the result. They said that the cause of death was the gunshot wound to the head. But unfortunately, this autopsy tells us very little without actual footage of the event in question, or without even knowing the police officer or trying to hear his side of the story, at least so far, because we don't even know who the identity is. Unfortunately, despite the fact that we do still have a severe lack of information, there are a lot of people that have taken it upon themselves to be judge, jury, and unfortunately, if not executioner, at the very least harasser when it comes to the protesters in this particular case. So the protesters have vowed, in light of this, to escalate their actions and their reaction to this news, the news that the footage would not be released, and the autopsy. So here's the issue that I have with this, and this goes back to something I was saying earlier. They would have escalated no matter what. It didn't matter what the findings were. It didn't matter what Aaliyah announced. They were going to escalate no matter what. They were going to assume the worst. They were going to assume that the police officer, maybe not every single protester, but at least the majority of them, based on the way that they've reacted, because they've been protesting something they don't even know what happened. And so the idea that they were going to use logic and reason, and if this tape had come out and shown that the police officer was 100% in the right, that Bradford was somebody that was threatening other people or threatening the police officer, even if that had taken place, based on these protesters' actions, you've got to believe that what they would have reacted to this, or they would have been like, oh, yeah, sure, that's fine. Okay, we'll just go home then. Guess we were wrong. Sorry, guys. I don't believe that would happen. Not based on the way they've reacted to it thus far. And so, that being said, I think what probably would happen is it wouldn't have mattered what came out. They would have escalated this and claimed that the police are terrorists and Klansmen, which they've been doing at these protests, including black police officers. So, if you're going to call somebody that you don't even know if they were there that night, you have no idea whether or not they were involved, if you're going to say to that person, you're a terrorist, you're a Klansman, this is clearly not somebody that is thinking or rational. This is somebody that hates police officers and will use any excuse to go after them and to attack them. This is not a rational thinking person. And this group would have done the same thing. So, to their credit, I will say this. The attorney, Ben Crump, and Jesse Jackson Sr. the other day at the press conference, they did urge nonviolence from protesters, which is more than you can say for a lot of the race baiters when situations like this come up. They don't actually advocate for violence most of the time, but they kind of leave the doorway open to it, and they kind of hint at they're okay with it. And so I do appreciate that they, at the very least, said, look, be respectful. Don't engage in violence. Don't engage in property damage. Just, you know, do your thing and protest. I would have called for an end of protest until we actually know what happened. But nonetheless, I did want to at least give them credit for that. So Carlos Chavez Jr., who's the leader of this protest, he did his best to get people whipped up instead. He didn't actually specifically call for violence, but he certainly did try to get the crowd whipped up in lieu of all this. So he was calling, like I said, police officers terrorists and Klansmen. Chavez also posted the name of a Hoover police captain. No idea whether or not that was the person involved in the shooting or not. In fact, I would imagine that if he's still the captain and he's still there, that he probably wasn't the officer involved specifically because the police officer, whom we don't know who it is, was put on leave when this happened. So they're not working right now. Allegedly, this police officer, this captain, that his address was posted by this crazy person, he is, so we know he's not the shooter. At least if you're following the logic there. So he posted the name of a Hoover police captain and posted a picture of his home. Now later, Facebook actually took this down and said it was inciting violence and it was hate speech, which to a degree I understand. Now I am very, very skeptical of even people I disagree with, Facebook or Twitter or any other social media, trying to censor them. But in this case, what they're essentially doing is they're saying, yeah, our medium is being used as a way to encourage people to harass private citizens and do so at their home. And so to that degree, as a company, you don't want to be seen as an accessory to a crime. And I understand that Facebook is trying to protect its brand. While I 100% don't agree with censorship, posting somebody's address and putting up pictures of their house, even though it may be quote-unquote public information, that's just not a good sign, because then you're basically using their company as a means to instruct you how to harass somebody, or you're saying, go get them, and encouraging them to do so. And so from a legal perspective, from a liability standpoint, even though I don't like the censorship, I kind of understand where Facebook is coming from on this one. You don't want to bear the legal burden of that. So this is really what I've been going back to constantly, and we'll give more information on it when it comes out, even though it seems to be sparse when it does. Even if you believe something wrong has happened here, and I don't think there's enough evidence to support that theory, at least yet, but even if you believe something wrong has happened here, it does not justify you doing wrong in response to it. So in other words, if you believe that Bradford actually was murdered by this police officer, that the police officer was just going out and he was bloodthirsty, he was looking for somebody to shoot, first of all, we don't know if that had any kind of racial motivation or if that's what actually happened. But even if you believe that it did, it still doesn't justify you shutting down roads, terrorizing private citizens, and going to people's houses that are not connected to the case at all. Even if they were connected, it still doesn't justify harassment. And so this is the standard that I want you to think about. Two wrongs do not ever make a right. If somebody has wronged you, as wicked as that may be, you do not take vengeance into your own hands. Or a wrong has happened to somebody else, you do not take vengeance into your own hands and think that you're above the law, especially when that involves people that were not connected to the alleged violation of your principles that took place. Especially when it's people that in this case had nothing to do with Bradford's death. And that's what's so unfortunate about this, is these protesters are involving and causing problems for people that aren't connected to the incident at all. They're like wild animals just lashing out at whoever happens to cross their path because they're angry, and in their mind that justifies them doing bad things. Man, a lot to talk about today. There's a lot going on in the world right now. And France and Europe, I really do feel for them because they have had so much going on in recent weeks. You've got the situation going on in Ukraine, which you know we've been talking about a lot. And there is some actual good news on that front, which I wasn't expecting. Apparently, Russia has kind of quit their, quit may be a strong word. They've reduced their bullying tactics when it came to Crimea. They're still in control of that region, but they have opened up the passageways to the Azov, I believe that's the way to pronounce it, the Azov Sea. And so they are letting Ukraine boats through now. And, I mean, that's a good development. It's far from a solution, But that is a step in the right direction, but there is a long way to go on that front. And another thing that's interesting is what's going on right now in France. And I really hate it for the French people, but they have been just erupting in different protests here recently. And if you're looking at what's going on, I mean, it looks like a war zone if you're looking at pictures from what's going on in Paris right now. And what's ironic about this, and you will not hear this from the mainstream media, ask yourself why these protests took place. Whenever the mainstream media reports it, what they're saying is, well, it's because of a tax hike in gas prices, which on its face is kind of true, but here's what they're leaving out. Do you know why Macron put those taxes forward? Do you know what those taxes are going for? In France, you have about 80% of the people, according to an opinion poll, that believe that global warming is a huge problem and it is detrimental and it's something that we need to do something about. And yet, despite this high approval rating of policies that they say should be put forward to curtail global warming, the reason for these taxes is so that they can fund the Paris Accords. That's what's going on here. And you're not hearing that from the mainstream media. The reason these protests are taking place are because of these taxes that were put in place specifically to fund the measures that France has to put in place now on its government to be in compliance with the Paris Climate Accords. And so basically the French people are taking the position, I guess, of, well, I think that we should do something about global warming, but I ain't going to pay for it. And you're seeing this outrage. They were the ones that were pushing and approving these stupid backwards policies. But now all of a sudden when they realize, oh, it actually is going to cost us billions of dollars, then they get upset about it because they're increasing their taxes. Which, again, I feel for the French people. And as somebody who is a big opponent of taxes myself, I understand the frustration. But keep in mind that it was your ideas and your policies that wound up eventually leading to this. And so when it comes to the French people, there is a genuine compassion coming from me on their behalf, but this is kind of something they did to themselves. That doesn't mean that there's no compassion there, but in retrospect, I can say, look, maybe you shouldn't have jumped headfirst into this thing. And this is the issue that you're running into. There was a similar tweet that came out that sort of, it's a very different news story, but it springs from the same problem. There was a town hall about climate change and a bunch of prominent Democrats showed up to it, one of which was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the newest and youngest person in the representative of the House. She hasn't actually taken office yet. That will be in the new year. But for the House of Representatives from New York's, I think, 8th district, I'd have to check the districts, but from that district, you have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she comes in and is talking about how the only way that we're going to be able to beat climate change is if we act courageously. And I'm sitting here thinking, what is courageous about spending other people's money? Seriously, explain that one to me. Your plan calls for taking money from the citizens and using that money to curtail a potential cataclysmic event, which there is very little evidence for, and you think may or may not be a big problem elsewhere. First of all, if we're going to spend that much money on anything, regardless of what it is, we need to be darn sure that the science is 100% foolproof on that. And in this particular case, where it's certainly not, that's not a wise use of funds. But even so, I don't understand this idea that that is somehow courageous. It's courageous to spend your money on something that is highly risky and may never come to pass, but it is certainly not courageous to do so with other people's money. If I'm spending somebody else's money and I buy a really nice steak dinner, that is not a courageous action. It doesn't really make any sense, but, you know, that's kind of par for the course when it comes to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And when we're talking about what's going on in Europe right now, and we're talking about what's going on in France, this is going to be a really big issue all across Europe, because what you're seeing is, you're seeing this divergence. this divergence in the two big sides of the issue, not just on climate change, but just in general in Europe. And the reason that I say that, and the reason that this is an important problem to point out, is that we're seeing very similar ideologies cropping up that happened in the first parts of World War I and World War II, or the lead up to them. This strong fight between socialism and nationalism. And you're seeing the same sort of protest happening in smaller scale in other nations in Europe. It's happening most prominently in France right now, but you're also seeing it happen with the bad Brexit deal that's happening in England, and some of the demands for England on what they're going to do in Brexit are just ridiculous. I mean, you're looking at it and they're basically saying, we want you to get none of the benefits of being in the EU, but we want you to be forced to have to deal with all of the obligations. So in other words, all the stuff that sucks about being in the EU, you have to continue to comply with those. But any of the stuff that you would get a benefit from, that you're not going to be able to get. It's one of the most ridiculous deals that I've ever seen. This whole them trying to force England into basically doing their bidding despite trying to get out of the EU, and that being the entire purpose for the vote. So you've got this real destabilization that is going on in Europe that we really need to keep an eye on, because otherwise it's going to kind of blindside us, and we're going to be standing there looking like, well, what happened to Europe? Well, these are problems that we need to deal with now, because again, this whole nationalism versus communism thing, that's exactly the same fight that led up to two world wars. Primarily World War II, I would say more so than World War I, but there was evidence that, you know, when World War I happened, there was a lot of nationalism that drove nations into that as well. So nonetheless, this is something that we need to keep our eye on. And even though this is a far less serious matter, it is an illustration of this culture war that is going on in Europe. There's a 69-year-old from the Netherlands who has just recently lost his court case to change his age. So for those of you who don't know, we did actually, it was just a regular segment. It was not the Daily Dose of Stupid, because actually I thought his argument, if you're going along with the logic that they are espousing in Europe, made a lot of sense. He's saying, despite me being 69, I feel 49 and I act as though I'm 49. Therefore, I should be able to change my legal age to 49. Well, if you're comparing that to gender, I don't see how there's an argument that applies to one that doesn't the other. There is one kind of argument that's a point in his favor, but nonetheless, if you're talking about a difference in the two, if you believe that gender is fluid and that you can be whatever gender you want to, and you come out and say, well, I feel as though I'm a woman even though I'm actually a man, and so I should be able to legally change my gender, then whenever you propose a reason why that is a bad idea, and I've done several of those, you cannot do that without applying the same logic to a change in age. And so the court there in the Netherlands has put out a statement on this, because they did hear his case, and this is what they ruled. This came out the other day. Mr. Rattleband, this is the guy who is trying to get his age changed from 69 to 49. Mr. Rattleband is at liberty to feel 20 years younger than his real age and act accordingly. Agreed. And then they say, amending his date of birth would cause 20 years of records to vanish from the register of births, deaths, marriages, and registered partnerships. This would have a variety of undesirable legal and societal implications. The priority must be to ensure that the public registers contain an accurate and factual information. Again, what is the difference in that and changing your gender? Because every argument they just made could also be made for someone legally trying to alter their gender. Let's read through it again real quickly. He's okay to feel 20 years younger than his real age and act accordingly. Yeah, if you're a guy and you think that you're a woman or vice versa, you're perfectly within your liberty to dress that way, to act that way. Nobody should be able to stop you. But there's a difference in saying I accept it and saying everybody else has to accept it. Everybody else has to be brought into submission. Everybody else has to acknowledge that I actually am a woman. Look, you can think you're a woman if you want to, And I'm not going to try to stop you from wearing a dress or anything like that. But the second you say that, no, you have to say I'm a woman, then we've got a problem. Then I have an issue with it. And they go on to say, amending his birth date would cause 20 years of records to vanish from the register of births, deaths, marriages, and registered partnerships. Oh, you mean like somebody that's changing their gender? How is that any different? If they've been on public record their entire life as a male or a female, and all of a sudden now you want to change that, that makes those records go away. That's saying that those records back then were wrong, or the records now are wrong, or however else you want to do it. It causes a slew of societal and legal problems. Because if you were a man, but now you're not a man, let's look at the draft. Let's look at the army, the selective service. Well, couldn't somebody just say that they're a woman in order to get out of having to serve? There's a myriad of reasons why this causes legal problems. But they are only willing to acknowledge it for whatever reason when it comes to age, and not willing to do so when it comes to gender. When you're talking about family, marriage, divorce, remarriage, custody laws, women are treated differently when it comes to things like divorce. Women are treated differently when it comes to the case where they get a certain amount of money from the divorce. Typically speaking, lawyers will favor the mother when it comes to custody battles. And so if you're a man, theoretically, all you would have to do is change your gender in order to be given that kind of consideration. And so there's a myriad of legal problems that come specifically with changing somebody's gender. And this is the issue that you're running into. So this idea that somehow this is an argument to not change your age, but it's not also an argument to not change your legal gender, your legal sex, there's just not a plain, clear, concise argument to be made here. So in reaction to this, the guy who wanted it to be done, Mr. Rattleband, he said, "When I am 69, I am limited. If I am 49, then I can buy a new house, drive a different car, I can take up more work. When I'm on Tinder and it says I'm 69, I don't get an answer. When I'm 49, with the face I have now, I will be in a luxurious position." Okay, so clearly this is a guy that thinks a lot of himself. But looking past that for example, again, let's replace the age thing with the gender thing. And this goes back to every bad argument that they make for being able to change your legal gender. So let's read that statement again, but insert gender instead of age. When I am a man, I am limited. If I'm a woman, then I can wear a dress. I can go out and get my hair done and wear it a different way. I get different looks from different people. I can take up certain kinds of jobs, like let's say, for example, a stripper or a Hooters girl or something like that, a job that is gender specific. And by the way, there are several professions where women tend to make more money, for example, nursing. So that's another argument there. You could also say, when I'm on Tinder, no men will talk to me when I'm a man, but if I'm a woman, then I will be in a luxurious position. Okay, so every argument that he's making to change his age, you can make that exact same argument when it comes to gender. And so again, they're not able to distinguish between the two. And that's why the only consistent stance to take is you shouldn't be able to change your age legally, and you also shouldn't be able to change your sex legally. You go with what you were born with. If you were born in 1949, then you have always been born in 1949, and that's never going to change legally. And if you were born with dude parts, you're a dude. If you were born with lady parts, you're a lady. Now, you can act like a man if you want to if you're a lady. You can talk like a man and dress like a man and spit like a man, whatever else you want to do. But legally speaking, you're still a female. You still have 2X chromosomes. You're going to be a female your entire life. If they dig you up 1,000 years from now and they're doing a study on your body and look at your DNA, they're going to say, yep, 2X chromosomes. That's a woman. And so why don't we just acknowledge that legally? If people want to dress up like that, I think it's wrong. I think it's weird, but they're free to do so. But there's a difference in that in saying the law must acknowledge it. No, the law doesn't have to acknowledge it. And in fact, doing so causes a myriad of other problems. That being said, Daily Dose of Stupid is up now.
Now you messed it up. You're stupid.
So the Daily Dose of Stupid today, once again, the topic of discussion is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Really, it's just, I could do nothing but look at her Twitter, and I don't do this, and I'm trying to limit myself to just, I don't know, maybe once a week doing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but the woman is just a gaffe machine, even better than Joe Biden. So she said this the other day, and by the way, this claim, it's not just right-leaning people that are pointing out that she royally screwed up. The, was it PolitiFact? Yeah, PolitiFact fact-checker gave her a false rating, and the Washington Post fact-checker gave her four Pinocchios. So not looking good for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on this one. So it just, it really astounds me that this woman has an actual degree in economics despite understanding so very, very, very little about economics. And I'm not an expert on this. I don't have a degree in it. I've never professed to be. I've read like maybe two books on economics. And so I'm by no means a specialist when it comes to economics. But this woman has an actual degree, like a bachelor's of science in economics, and still doesn't seem to know the very bare bones basics. And that to me is a cause for concern and should be. So in this particular tweet, she's trying to explain why alleged waste in the military spending, and there is some waste, of course, we all know that. Doesn't matter how liberal you are, how conservative you are, waste is going on in our military just like every other branch of the government. And so she brings up how waste in military spending somehow means that we can afford single-payer government health care. So she stumbles through trying to explain why that is the case. Let's go ahead and look at the tweet that we have here. Yeah, there we go. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez saying $21 trillion of Pentagon financial transactions could not be traced, documented, or explained. By the way, that quote is coming out of an article from The Nation, which we'll discuss in a second. $21 trillion in Pentagon accounting errors, Medicare for all costs, $32 trillion. That means 66% of Medicare for all could have been funded by the Pentagon, and that's before our premiums. Okay, so there's a number of reasons why this is a really bad point, but let's just hit the facts. So first of all, she's citing that article from The Nation, and I'll go ahead and read the full quote just so you understand exactly what she was quoting. It says in that article from The Nation, in all, at least a mind-boggling $21 trillion of Pentagon financial transactions between 1998 and 2015 could not be traced, documented, or explained. So here's the problem with that. It's not as though this $21 trillion just went somewhere and nobody can figure out where it went. That's not what happened. And that's, again, something that somebody that has a degree in economics should understand about accounting. That when you're talking about these transactions, it's not as though that money evaporated. It went somewhere. You just may not know exactly where it went. And because it is an accounting error, it doesn't mean that it's always a new dollar bill. For example, if you have a $1 bill and you transfer that to another department and you can't explain why that bill was transferred, and then you transfer that dollar bill to another department and you lost the receipt for it so you don't know how that dollar got there, that counts as $2. And this is taking place with millions and sometimes billions of dollars over the course of a long period of time. And so what you've got there is the same dollar can be counted multiple times if it's involved in transactions that cannot be accounted for. And so it's not like $21 trillion got transferred and then they lost it. It's still in a department there somewhere. They just don't know exactly where that may be or can't explain the transaction that took place. And so that same dollar can be counted over and over and over and over again if transferred in this way. And over the time period that they're talking about, 1998 to 2015, which would be 17 years, you can imagine that those same dollars can be transferred or mistransferred, as the case may be, and be counted over and over and over again. And so, no, there are not $21 trillion just sitting in a safe somewhere that we've all forgotten about. And furthermore, furthermore, also, it does not mean that those dollars were necessarily gone. So let's say that there was an accounting error where they don't know exactly where that dollar went. It doesn't mean that the dollar itself vanished. It probably went to purchase something. Now, it may have been the wrong thing because it was a transaction that wasn't accounted for properly. It may have purchased the wrong thing, but it doesn't mean that asset and that monetary value isn't still somewhere inside the department. And so, again, it's not like these $21 trillion were actually lost. By the way, in that same time period, which again was 1998 to 2015, the Department of Defense spent about $500 billion. So she's saying that $21 trillion could have paid for it. No, if you're looking at that time span, $500 billion for that 17-year span. That is 42 times less than the $21 trillion she's alleging could somehow pay for Medicare for All, which is just code for single-payer healthcare. I mean, there's no difference. Bernie Sanders was calling for single-payer healthcare up until the point where he changed the name to Medicare for All. That is really the only difference here. And you'll notice that now he says Medicare for All, where he used to be saying single-payer healthcare, it's the same thing. He just changed the name of it to make it more marketable. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, being the loyal Bernie supporter that she is, just went right along with it. But when you're talking about this, the whole budget for the entire 17 years of the Department of Defense was $500 billion, 42 times less than the amount that she's saying somehow could have magically paid for Medicare for All. And even if it were true, even if there really were a $21 trillion that the Pentagon lost and could have been spent on other things, you're still not dealing with a couple of other issues. First of all, a mismanagement of money is not an excuse to buy future things. If anything, it's an argument against it. For example, if you were dealing with this in your own home, you wouldn't say, man, I lost that $1,000 last week. Well, you know what? That $1,000 would have gone a long way for paying for a brand new entertainment system in my TV, my TV room. That means I can afford a new TV and new speakers. That's not how that works. You misplacing money is in no way an excuse to be able to buy future things. If anything, it means you ought to be more cautious and not buy things because you might misplace money again. And so it makes absolutely no sense that even if $21 trillion actually were misplaced, and there actually was $21 trillion somewhere that we didn't know where it was, that that would somehow pay for Medicare for All. It doesn't justify a bigger new purchase. And furthermore, there's also the issue of the Constitution. Whether you like it or not, Medicare for All is never authorized in the Constitution, period, ever. There is nothing in the Constitution that allows you to take money from one citizen to give to another citizen. And if you understand the 10th Amendment, you understand why that's the case. The 10th Amendment never, according to it, only the powers that are specifically granted to the federal government by the Constitution are the ones that it is allowed to engage in. And Medicare for All is never mentioned. A military is, multiple times, actually. And so we can quibble, and I think that there's a decent argument to be had about waste and fraud and mismanagement in the Pentagon, as there is in every other department in the federal government. There's things that we can cut. There's things that we need to scale back on. I agree with that, and I'm open to having that conversation. But the difference is, when we're talking about that, we're talking about something the Constitution actually authorizes. When you're talking about Medicare for All, sorry, nowhere in the Constitution. So you can't even get past that hurdle. Now, if you want to amend the Constitution that says we have to pay for people's health care, I mean, good luck with that. I don't think you're going to be able to actually do it. But if that's the case, then do it. Propose an amendment to the Constitution. Yeah, it'll probably fail, but at least then you will have been doing it the right way. At least then you're actually doing it through the process by which you can actually change the duties of the federal government. Doing it this way doesn't work. And so when you're talking about spending, we can argue about whether the military is spending too much or not spending enough. But when we're having that conversation, we're talking about something that the Constitution actually authorizes. When you're talking about Medicare for All, you're getting way beyond the boundaries of what the federal government was ever intended to do. And so you're also completely ignoring that when you're saying, well, we could have used that money to spend it on Medicare for All. And this is one of the weird misconceptions that I've noticed about the left. The left seems to believe that the military is a giant bulk of our spending. The military typically accounts for roughly 18% of our entire federal budget. You know what accounts for about 50% of that? Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. It accounts for way more of our federal budget than military spending, and all three of those programs are not constitutional. And so it doesn't really make any sense that they have this misnomer that they believe that the military is this giant chunk of our spending. And it's almost a fifth. That's a big chunk, but it is nothing compared to the social welfare programs that they're talking about. And in an attempt to backpedal, one of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's spokespeople tried to say that, well, what she was really trying to highlight is it's a question of priorities. And it's a question of what you're putting your emphasis on. We're not investing in the health and well-being of our people. Well, first of all, I would argue that military is absolutely investing in the health and well-being of your people to keep other countries from killing your people. That seems to be a pretty big health issue. But nonetheless, again, you're dealing with something that is constitutionally authorized versus something that is not constitutionally authorized. And that's something that the left seems to completely ignore. And for whatever reason, they believe that we're spending so much more money on the military than we are the social programs that they proposed. And the exact opposite is actually true. We're spending far more on social welfare programs than we ever have on our military. In fact, this $21 trillion figure that she's giving, according to the Washington Post, that's larger than all the money we have ever, ever spent on national defense in the entire history of the country, from 1776 to now. And so, again, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez puts her foot in her mouth, and that's part of the reason that it's very hard for people to take her seriously. All right, let's go to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on Tactics.
Chaplain's Report this morning comes from the Book of Ruth, and we are going to be talking about Ruth for some time. I don't know why. I just got it in my head one day that we were going to go through Ruth, and I guess it was because I was reading it on my own time, but I wanted to go through Ruth and sort of continue this series that we've started on her, because I think there's just so many powerful messages contained within this book about humans and human relationships and what we should be looking for in other people, both as a mate and just in general, in surrounding ourselves with people that encourage us and help us in our faith. So to give you a little bit of backstory on this, what's going on here is that Ruth has now gone out into the fields and she's gleaning in the fields of a man named Boaz. So she's gleaning, she's taking food from his field that he has left behind for those that are less fortunate. And you'll remember that we were talking about yesterday in the introduction to Ruth 2 that she is seeking out because she's gleaning because she needs the food, but she's also gleaning for somebody that she would find favor in their sight. In other words, she's hoping that the person who happens to own this particular field is somebody that may or may not be a potential husband. And so she goes out into this field who happens to be a relative of Naomi's, her mother-in-law. And when she does, this is what happens, and we talked about yesterday that she went out there and sought him out, but we also get to now see Boaz's reaction to her. So we look at Ruth 2, verses 8 through 11. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field where they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Then, if we'll look down in verse 10, "Then she fell on her face, bowing before the ground, and said, 'Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?' Boaz replied to her, 'All that you have done for your mother-in-law,
after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know.
So I think this says a lot about who Boaz is as a man. And we were talking a lot about Ruth seeking Boaz out. Now we're starting to see this relationship develop between the two of them. So yesterday we were talking about how important it is for Ruth to look for a man that can be a provider for her, somebody that wants to take care of her and protect her and has the means and the desire, the work ethic to do all those things and to be the kind of man that can provide for a wife. That's important for Ruth to look at, but that's the baseline. That's the bare minimum. That's the starting point. When we're going out and looking for relationships, when young ladies are looking for young men to be their spouses, that should be the bare minimum. That should be really anybody that isn't willing to do that, that's a non-starter. You don't even consider that person. After they've met that threshold, then you can start looking at, okay, who would be a good partner for me? And this is really the kind of stage that we're seeing proposed in Ruth 2, because now Ruth has finally met Boaz and she starts questioning him. And really, this, again, has a powerful message for both men and women from different perspectives. I think the message that this passage gives for women is that you look for a man that not only can provide, but is compassionate enough and wants to provide. In other words, he's able to provide, but he's not doing so because he feels obligated to or because he feels like he's getting something out of you. He's doing so because he has compassion on you. Boaz apparently knew Ruth and Naomi's story, but he wasn't doing this because he thought that Ruth could be a potential mate for him or anything like that. The reason Boaz did it is because he wanted to. Keep in mind, for his fields to be ripe for gleaning, that meant that Boaz, long before Ruth ever got to his doorstep, had already made a conscious decision in his heart. What I'm going to do is I'm going to leave aside a portion of my land in accordance with God's law to do so to provide for those that are less fortunate. I mean, sure, it's land that I could harvest and I could make some money off of it and all of that, but I have a lot, I have plenty, and because of that, I want to obey God and do what he said and leave food for the less fortunate. This is a compassionate individual. And you remember when Jesus is talking on the Sermon on the Mount, and he talks about if the law compels you to do so-and-so, for example, go with somebody a mile, go with them too. If somebody asks for your coat, give them your cloak also. This is the kind of person that Boaz was. Because what Boaz is doing is he's saying to Ruth, not only am I allowing you to glean out of my fields, but you stay in my field and you don't go to anybody else's. There'll be plenty here for you to take care of. And I tell you what, since you don't have a place to stay, you can stay with my maids. And if you want anything to drink, you can go ahead and go to the jars of water and do that too. All the law required him to do was to provide gleaning. All it required him to do is to leave parts of his field to allow him to do that. And he says, no, that's not enough. I'm going to go above and beyond and to comply with the spirit of God's law, helping those that are less fortunate than me. And then Ruth is really taken aback by this and asks, why? I'm a foreigner. Nobody has treated me this way. Why are you going to all these great lengths? And Boaz gives a great answer. He says, because I know your story. I know what you're willing to do for the people around you. I know the kind of person that you are because you left your land, you left everything you knew to take care of your mother-in-law. He has a respect for her. Now keep in mind, this is a man who is very wealthy talking to a beggar woman that has no means to provide for herself. That's why she's gleaning in the first place. And yet, there is a very clear sense of respect that comes from Boaz. And I think that this is a real testament to the kind of man that he is and something that young women should be looking for in a mate. You don't only look for somebody that's willing to provide for you, but somebody that is willing to provide for others, to be a resource to others, that people around him are going to respect because he does go above and beyond, and he does do the best that he can to help others out, whether he's getting something out of it or not. That's the kind of man that women should be looking for in a husband. And I think that you can also see from this passage, there is a powerful lesson for what men should be looking in women.
Boaz is not saying, well, the reason I'm doing all this and the reason I'm going this extra mile with you is because I think you're really attractive. No, because I want you to be my wife. No, he doesn't say that either. He's not looking for anything out of her. Why is he so kind to her? Because he says, I see the goodness in you. I see the kind of person that you are. I see that you are like me in the sense that you're willing to help people. And so, young men, when you are looking for somebody to be your mate, that's what you need to be looking for. Somebody that has strong family values, that has a strong sense of loyalty, and somebody that is willing to do things that are out of their way for other people. And in this case, also a woman that is willing to seek after God, because you remember she made a commitment back when we were looking at some of the earlier verses, that she is going to stay with Naomi and that her God would be my God. That's what Ruth was saying. She has a commitment to follow the Lord. And Boaz sees that not only in her words, but also now in her actions, in that she has come to a foreign land to be with Naomi. And she was not only a beggar, but a foreign beggar. And Boaz still has this sense of respect for her because he sees her actions and he sees her kindness and her compassion and her empathy. And it's something that he admires and talks about in her. So Boaz wants to help Ruth because he understands that she wants to help others too, just like he does. She may not necessarily have the means that he does, but the attitude is the same. And so we see this kinship starting to develop between the two of them, and that forms the basis for a strong relationship between the two of them. And that's really the overall message here. This relationship starts to blossom because both of them have their priorities straight and they're looking for the right thing in a mate. Boaz is a full, complete person who is also looking for another full, complete person that has similar ideas and similar values to him, that wants to follow God and to do so by helping other people. Doesn't matter that they don't have the same means or that they're helping people in different ways. The attitude and the underlying principles and virtue are still there. And it's a strong message. If you're seeking out a relationship, that's the kind of person that you want to be with. And Boaz understood it and Ruth understood it. And we eventually know where all of that led. Stay the course, friends.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.